Thank you for joining us today at the kickoff to the budget hearings for the City and County of Denver. It will be the 2020 budget overview, and my name is Stacey Gilmore, and I represent District 11 for the City and County of Denver. And before we get started, I wanted to let folks know that we're planning on about 45, 50 minutes for the presentation, and we'll be taking names in a queue, so just let me know. And then if folks could also make sure that they reference in their question the slide number or page number of the budget book, that would be helpful for folks. And we're excited to have Brendan Hanlon, our Chief Financial Officer, with the city here today for the presentation. But before we get started, if we could go ahead and do a round of introductions. And we'll start.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman. Michael Hancock.
Good afternoon, Alan Salazar, Chief of Staff.
Evan Dreyer with the Mayor's Office.
Sky Stewart, Legislative Director.
Amanda Sawyer, District 5.
Chris Herndon, District 8.
Amanda Sandoval, District 1.
Deborah Ortega, City Council at Large.
Stephanie Adams, Budget Management Director.
Laura Perry, Capital Planning and Programming Director.
Candy Cedevaca, District 9.
Paul Cashman, South Denver, District 6.
Kevin Flynn, Southwest Denver, District 2.
Kendra Black, District 4.
Joel Clark, Lucky District 7.
Great. Thank you very much. Again, Brendan Hanlon, the city's Chief Financial Officer. Thanks for being here this afternoon for the 2020 budget overview. Before I get started, I wanted to just thank the Budget and Management and Capital Planning and Programming teams who helped develop this budget. I also wanted to acknowledge all the work that has gone into this budget by agency staff. Many, many hours of deliberative processes have gone into this, as well as the mayor and his administration. So with that, I'm going to get started and spend some time on our economic indicators, as well as I will be giving the presentation on our revenues. So I had mentioned during the press conference that I'm nearing my 18th year here with the city, and I would say that this is one of the more challenging budgets that we had to formulate, in that we still have the demands of a growing city, but we have seen revenue moderation. And I wanted to start off with a few slides to just talk about some of the economic climate that we're seeing, much on the national level, but some here in Denver as well. And this slide really goes over some notes as to strength in our job market, or our national job market still being robust, but a deceleration in our economy is real. We have multiple indicators that have historically sounded the alarm for a recession. I want to just point out that I'm not saying that we are in recessionary conditions here in the city and county of Denver at this point in time, but we're seeing indicators at the national level that mean that we have to act in a responsible fashion and make sure that we're prepared for any uncertainty that is likely coming our way. We've seen federal interest rate cuts, a yield curve inversion. I'm going to talk more about yield curve. I'm sure that'll be an exciting part of my presentation today. Contraction in the manufacturing sector and declining business confidence. But that's also paired with long-term expansion. So we're in the 10th year of economic expansion, one of the longest, if not the longest, in the nation's history. A strong home price appreciation, which I think we've all experienced here in Denver, and historically low unemployment. We are seeing mixed indicators at this point in time, which means that we need to be cautious as we move forward into 2020 and beyond. I'm not going to go through all of these clips, but I'm often checking the economic news every single day, and there's a mixed bag worth of media coverage on the economy. A couple weeks ago, when the yield curve inverted, there was a lot of doom and gloom type news around, are we on the eve of a recession? And then this week, we're nearing historic highs in the market. So that seems to be the turbulence that we have been experiencing. We will likely continue to experience, even in light of the oil refinery attack that you saw over the weekend. That's put a lot of uncertainty into the energy market. So those kind of reverberations internationally and nationally will have an impact on our economy. So, as I mentioned, yield curve. This is a chart of the yield curve. So that is the difference between short-term interest rates and long-term interest rates. And an inversion in the yield curve is when your short-term interest is better or higher than your long-term interest prospects. And that should promote some confusion, because you would think, oh, the longer I invest money, the better my return should be. Well, that means that there's generally a lack of confidence in what the future holds. And this is a chart that shows both the 10-year to 2-year spread in interest rates, as well as the 10-year and 3-month spread in interest rates. And you'll notice that this pink section here is the last economic downturn, and just before it, we saw that inversion. So coming out and then in through the recession itself, we experienced the removal of that inversion characteristic. But just before that downturn, we experienced the inversion, and we are experiencing that same inversion as we stand right now. Again, I was reading numerous articles, and in one day when the interest rates inverted for the first time, it was the recession is coming, and you need to be prepared. And then the very next day, same news outlet said, inverted yield curve means little to nothing, and this is no sign of any sort of economic softening at all whatsoever. So it's something to be taken with a grain of sand, but we want to make sure that we keep an eye on this indicator as we go forward. That indicator informs this next one, and this is the prediction of a recession based off of that Treasury spread. In August 2020, probability of recession in August 2020 stands at just under 38% at this point in time. So, some stats for Colorado. This is a new slide, so I'm going to try to call out new slides for council members who have been through this before. This is not a slide that we had in the past, but it is the Leeds Business Confidence Index. So this is a consumer, business confidence index for businesses in Colorado. And what you see here is a trend over time of confidence, and this gray area or this light blue area here in the middle is during the recession. And then what you see is coming out of the recession is a stability and a positive outlook. This 50 line in the middle is neutral. It's a neutral perspective on the economy. Anything above 50 is positive, below that is negative. And what you see here, this dashed line, is the Leeds School forecast going into the end of 2019. And what backs all of that up is this slide, which is individual index elements broken out by each category. So what you see here, and for those of you in the back who might be able to read this, this dark blue line is the perspective of businesses on the state economy, then the national economy, industry sales, industry profits, industry hiring, and capital expenditures, all perspectives on the Colorado businesses as to how they see the state national economy and how they plan on spending as they move into the end of 2019. And what you see here in the third and fourth, the third quarter number is an estimate, and so are the expected quarter four numbers. And you see those turning negative across the board. So something that our Colorado businesses are telling us about the economy is that there is more uncertainty to come. And I think that national environment is starting to percolate here. Back to a traditional measure that I usually bring up, and this is consumer confidence. Again, this significant dip here in the middle was the recession itself. We've had a steady climb back from the recession, but we've started to see some moderation in consumer confidence. The reason that is important is because it gives you a sense of how comfortable consumers are to spend. And of course, for us, being so dependent on sales and use tax, that's a very important measure. I will say that this is a national consumer confidence model, but it has helped inform consumer confidence in Colorado and in Denver itself. Unemployment, another measure that has been traditionally presented, and this is one that remains positive with historic lows of 3.7 nationally, 3.7% unemployment nationally, and 2.7% here in the metro area. So these statistics for unemployment still remain strong. Again, a mixed bag of economic statistics. Skipped one here. So a new chart that we've not shown very often, this is the first time we presented it, but it's an element of what we're starting to look at internally in the Department of Finance, really drilling into the economic performance inside the city and county of Denver itself. And this is taxable sales. So this isn't sales and use tax. This is taxable sales activity in the city and county of Denver. And I'm going to read these off just in case you can't read them at home. Construction and home improvement is the light blue line. Furniture, clothing, electronics, and online purchases is dark blue. Marijuana transactions in green, no pun there. Tourism and dining in a middle blue color. We should have probably just picked something other than blue. Vehicle sales in black and manufacturing in gray. And what you see is this middle line here is 0% performance. So anything below this zero line is negative performance in those sales categories. Anything above that, of course, is positive. And I think in my talking points during the press conference, I said we've been seeing a mixed bag in terms of performance in some of these industries, specifically around construction and home improvement, manufacturing, and furniture, clothing, and electronics have been performing in a negative fashion. But we've been fortunate that dining and tourism-related activities have been more than positive and a larger overall share of the pie, which have brought those numbers up. So we've been positively affected by a few categories, but it's something that we need to keep an eye on as we move forward. Of course, an element of taxable sales is what do we generate in terms of core sales and use tax. And I'm going to talk a little bit about tax collections in a moment, but I think it's important to see those trends over time. This really highlights our sales and use tax performance going back to 2012 and 13. So that's the 6.5% number. Our robust year of sales and use tax collections in 2014 at 12%. But what we've seen is still some strength, 7.29, 5.8, 7.34 here at the end of 2018 in the first 6 months of each of these years. But what we've experienced in the first 6 months of 2019 is 3.72. And that's a big change. This is why we're going to talk about revising our sales and use tax forecast down. With that, we still, though, still see some strengths. Again, mixed bag of indicators, mixed bag of revenue performance. In building permits and valuation, but we are noticing a moderation, a forecasted moderation from community planning and development in terms of a projection of permit valuation for building values in 2020. Lodging tax activity. Again, room counts remain strong year over year, as well as occupancy rates and room rates. This line here is a bit deceiving. This is $143 per night is the average room stay. This goes up to $145. So it's still showing growth, even though we've been adding inventory to our lodging profile here in the city and county of Denver, as well as regionally. We still see strong performance in these numbers. Again, that is the tourism and food activity is helping propping up some of those weaker areas. So overall general fund revenue, and for those of you who have not been through this presentation before, I focus a lot on the general fund because that is where the crux of our service delivery comes from. You will also receive presentations on human services, which has their own special revenue fund and property tax dedication, as well as enterprise funds in parks and recreation. The Golf Enterprise Fund is funded there, DDPHE and public works, and the airport as well. So you'll see the total profile of the city's performance. But we're going to be really focused on the general fund right now. So our overall funding capacity is only growing by 2% bottom line when you include our use of fund balance. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit as part of our revenue profile. 2020 revenue growth is off of a revised 2019 budget that we have revised down to accommodate for the fact that we are seeing less growth in sales and use tax. And then base agency generated revenue accounts for nearly one quarter of general fund revenue, but is only growing by 1.6% in 2020. So, sales and use tax. In 2019, our year-to-date estimate is 3.7%. Our forecast, our revised forecast, is 4% overall. This has been revised down from 5.5%. You might wonder, well, boy, that you are below your forecasted number. Why would you have kept it at 4% at this point in time if you're concerned about the outlook for the rest of 2019? It's important to remember that on that previous slide, I'm going to go back a few here. On the previous slide, when we look at our performance through the first 7 months of the year, this 7.34 was the stronger component of 2018. So this first half of 2019 is growing over the stronger performance. The second half of 2018 performed in a weaker fashion. We believe that there's enough economic activity to overperform that last half of the year and make sure that we could come in at that 4%. We weren't confident at 5.5, but we were confident at the 4% number. Sorry. So for 2020, 4% core sales and use tax growth, which is consistent with state forecasts. The Office of State Planning and Budgeting and Colorado Ledge Council range between 4.2 and 3.8% in their forecasts for 2020. It's also important to note that Stapleton retained tax, that's a share of taxes that come back to the general fund from the Stapleton TIF, came back or are coming back in 2020. This accounts for $15.7 million in our overall revenue profile. It's important to know that that was forecasted years out, that this would be bumped up, and that we would be the beneficiary of the sales and use tax collections out at Stapleton. Marijuana sales tax, 4.31% is the standard tax. That is the new revised number after the new ballot measures have gone into effect as of 2019. 5.5% is our special amount. Remember, a portion of that goes into the general fund, and a portion of that goes into the Affordable Housing Fund as well. Total marijuana sales tax projected to grow by 30% due in part to the new rates being implemented. So remember, the general fund is not the beneficiary of those tax rate increases. Those are going to those dedicated purposes. Marijuana sales tax represents about 4.8% of the general fund's overall revenue. And just a correction here, I'd written down 2.4. That was my mistake. It is actually 0.9% of all general or all fund revenues across the entire city. Other revenue, property tax is estimated collections are $540 million. This is a citywide number. The general fund is going to be growing up to the total cap of 6% plus local growth or $21.5 million for the general fund alone. We are estimating that a credit of 2 mils is going to be required to stay within our 2A, so this isn't the park's 2A, this is the old Tabor growth constraint 2A, so we removed Tabor's revenue growth constraints and we implemented our own, and that's the 6% plus local growth. In order to stay underneath that revenue growth proposition, we will have to credit or reduce 2 mils on people's tax bills to stay within that revenue growth profile. Occupational privilege tax, it is an amount that is charged $9.75 per employee per month that is shared between the employee and the employer, approximately $56 million in 2020. That's up about 2% over 2019's numbers. Agency-generated revenue, so I had said that was relatively flat. Included in there is $15 million worth of agency proposals, which include expenditure reimbursements. So think of any staff that we add down here, downtown, that supports the airport, for example. We are reimbursed by that enterprise fund in a one-for-one fashion, so the revenue profile includes that reimbursement, as well as new revenue proposals, one of which is this last proposal, which is here, which is $4 million in estimated credit card fee revenues from online transactions. That is something that we had been compensating in terms of each transaction on behalf of all of our residents. This is something that we are changing as part of the 2020 budget process. Other sources, so this year, because we had revenue constraints, we were as dynamic and thoughtful about other sources of revenue that could be leveraged to advance our priorities. The first one of those was human services mills and transfer dollars. So you'll all note that we created a new host housing department. That was created through the composition of multiple revenue streams on the general fund side, but also monies moving from human services into the general fund. We have then allocated mills from the human services, social services mill levy into the general fund mill levy, only to the extent that those were used to fund housing positions in human services that are now being housed out of the general fund. Environmental Services Enterprise Fund revenue. These dollars were used to create the new Office of Climate and Sustainability, and that fund is also supporting the purchase and lease of compost vehicles to advance our sustainability goals and our diversion goals in our solid waste function. CIP. So the capital improvement program was also the beneficiary of growth in our overall property taxes. They have taken on a funding of a significant portion of primarily mobility investments that had previously been a general fund transfer. So thanks to the ability of the capital improvement program to fund those proposals, we were able to sustain that mobility commitment in our 2020 budget. And then I had mentioned before, there are positions that are partially funded by the airport. They reimburse us for those costs. I can't complete my presentation without talking about reserves. I'm going to talk about it in the DOF presentation as well, but we have three layers of reserves that are built into our budget each and every year. The first is contingency reserve. This is a charter requirement of 2% of expenditures. It sits at $29.6 million. It requires a council approval to transact out of, so you'll see us come through, and you already have seen us come through with some supplemental proposals coming through council. It is transacted out of that contingency number and then allocated to the agencies that need those funds. The second is our undesignated fund balance, which is our policy to maintain 15% of expenditures for a reserve. We are able to use the dollars between 15% and 10% to accommodate a recession. We did this during the Great Recession. Those reserves went from 15% down to 10.7% to accommodate the fact that we lost revenue growth during that five-year period of time. And then lastly, the state required Tabor Emergency Reserve Fund, which is 3% of all covered funds, and that is approximately $52 million in both cash as well as facilities that are attributable to that reserve. And I just wanted to end with this slide. I had mentioned in my kickoff that, you know, we had revenue constraints. We were growing by a net 2% year over year. One of the major reasons that is going on is because we have been the beneficiary of being able to use fund balance or those reserves above and beyond our 15% policy. We were able to bake those into those dollars above 15% into our overall general fund profile for spending in each of the past 6 years. This is a snapshot of time. It goes back to 2000. Our use goes actually back to 2014 after the Great Recession. And you'll notice that the red bars are the areas to focus in. Often during this presentation, I'll get questions about, hey, can we use fund balance for a myriad of different investment strategies? And my answer is traditionally, yes, we have. You see it in the budget before you. This just demonstrates the constraints that we had moving into 2019 and into 2020. We didn't have this tool in a as robust fashion as we had in the past. It was a tool that allowed us to advance a lot of city priorities. I think what we've done here is moved responsibly to look for other sources, dynamic ideas to identify funding to allow us to invest in our key priorities. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Stephanie Adams to talk about those priorities.
Thank you, Brendan. My name is Stephanie Kiranis Adams. I have the privilege of serving as the city's budget and management director. Brendan already thanked the budget office, but I wanted to do another shout out to the team. They worked really hard on this very challenging budget, as well as my colleagues and agencies who were very patient partners through this process. So I'm going to take a minute to talk about the process itself. So we actually start in April, and we meet with agencies and have a conversation about the upcoming budget season. We give our forecasts, we talk about the year that just closed, and then in June, agencies submit their requests for additional investments for the upcoming year. This year, in 2020, we also asked them to submit budget savings ideas, because as we understood the constraints of our budget, we recognized that one of the best ways to fund those things that we know we have pressures around, some of the priorities, is to see if we could use existing resources and prioritize those resources to invest in our priorities. And agencies, you know, really took up the call, really looked in at their budgets and did some of the things that I think the public would expect us to do, which is look at their discretionary items and think about travel, training, those kinds of things. And those are the items that they will talk about over the next week or so. In July, agencies meet with the CFO and walk through their needs for the upcoming year. And then in August, we meet with the mayor and agencies talk through their needs for 2020 as well. All along the way, the budget team is working with agencies to understand what their needs are, understand if there are opportunities for things like scalability, if we were able to fund maybe not five people, but three, what could we do? Are there phasing options? Does this have to start January 1st, or could it start in the middle of the year? Those are the kind of work that's happening over the summer. And then, of course, we are required to provide you with the mayor's proposed budget, which he did last Monday. And here we are today going through the agency presentations. As part of the process, we always ask agencies to submit performance metrics, understand how what they're asking for aligns with their strategic plans. And this year, we introduced race and social justice into the budget process. And as we introduced that and asked agencies to answer these questions for every request they were making, as a result of your budget submission, which communities benefit from your request and how? As a result of your budget submission, which communities are impacted or burdened by your request and how? And if they had the information, how does your budget request reduce gaps in racial and ethnic outcomes? While we were doing the budget process, during that time, agencies were also receiving training. So we were doing those things in parallel and work with agencies. And what you'll find over the next week is that agencies will speak to these three questions as part of their budget process as well. So this is a pie chart that explains to you how we distributed the general fund budget for 2020. What this does is it represents a 2% increase overall in our expenditures for 2020. You can see that the top three program areas are public safety. So that includes fire, police, sheriff, as well as our executive director of safety in that pie, that piece of the pie. Public Works, of course, is about 10% of our overall general fund budget. Parks and Rec, 9%. This is just the general fund, by the way. This does not include, for instance, 2A or any kind of capital investments that we're making. This is sort of my budget geek out slide, so bear with me here. But it's really important for you to know that before we add a single new item to the budget, it costs more, oftentimes, to deliver the same level of service. And so our first action as part of the budget process is to understand what we need to increase investment for, increase resources for, to sustain our existing level of service. About 68% of the 2020 budget is personnel. And so it was important to preserve and make sure that we could have a merit increase for our hardworking public employees. We also invested in the general fund with an investment of $2.7 million for the minimum wage ordinance that passed this year for our city employees. We also increased the city's investment for the Denver Employee Retirement Plan. I have another slide to talk a little bit about that. And so the city is actually increasing its investment by 1.75%, which is roughly $7.8 million. There's also an annualized savings. So remember a minute ago I was talking about phasing things in. So in 2019, we had some investments we made in 2019 that we didn't make for a whole year. So think about police and fire. If we were doing academies, we know that people might be into academy over the summer and the fall, and so we're only paying for a portion of that person's time in 2019. But in 2020, we will, of course, pay for the full cost of those phased-in investments, and that was about $5 million of 2020's budget. And then we also have already baked in our collective bargaining agreement increases. That is with fire and police, by the way. Sheriff is going into collective bargaining at the end of this year and is not in the 2020 budget, but we will work with them through the collective bargaining process and accommodate whatever comes out of that agreement the next year. And in addition, just like you know, your budget at home, there are also some non-personnel increases. So the cost of utilities or maintenance, those kinds of things cost more in the upcoming year. And we'll have agencies come through and talk a little bit about how important it is and some additional increases that we had to make starting out 2020 to accommodate that. Just a really quick, especially for city employees who are watching. So starting in January of 2020, the city will contribute now 14.75% of pay towards retirement, and employees will contribute 10.25%. That represents an increase of 3.5%. That has been split 50-50 between the city and employees, which is something we've traditionally done whenever we've made an increase in DIRP. So the reason for the contribution increase is that the DRP actually had hired an actuary who came in and did an assessment of the health of the fund and applied a different methodology. Their previous methodology was fine, but this was a best practices methodology, and as a result of that, it required an additional increase for the contribution from the city. The city has always been dedicated to the health of the retirement program, and I think that you've probably heard across the nation, other retirement programs that have had some challenges. We continue to support and invest in our retirement plan. So hopefully all of you have a handy dandy handout that looks something like this, and that kind of gives you a quick overview of the investments that we are making for 2020. I'm going to dive a little bit into each of these categories very quickly, but agencies will come through with a lot more information on some of these investments. I'm going to primarily touch on the general fund investments we're making for 2020. I'm not going to read through all of these because you have them in front of you, but our hallmark of our affordability and support for people experiencing homelessness was really the creation of the Housing Stability Department. And we're excited to have them come together, and as Brendan mentioned, we're moving dollars, but also services that were previously in Human Services, for instance, to come over to the Housing Stability Fund, as well as taking the Housing Division from our Economic Development Office. They're bringing them together to provide a more comprehensive perspective on trying to support affordable housing and, of course, homelessness. To prevent homelessness and to address homelessness. In addition to those, we also are investing $1.9 million in the Solutions Center, which we anticipate will be opening in 2020. And then we will also be investing about $390,000 to continue a treatment on demand pilot that was started by Denver Health that we will continue to invest in 2020. So we also recognize the importance in 2020 of an equitable city, and there are various kinds of investments we've made for 2020, which includes investing additional resources in our neighborhood equity and stabilization team, so trying to bolster the work that they're doing in our neighborhoods. We also invested a little bit in our race and social justice initiative, and so I know that council went through a training recently with that team, and so continuing to support their work moving into 2020. And we will, you'll find, well, actually, you're not going to hear from our colleagues over in county court, but there was House Bill 1263, which really takes some drug offenses and turns them into misdemeanors, which is really a good, strong way to think about justice reform. It also requires us to be able to have the staffing to support those cases, which we're estimating to be anywhere between 2,000 to 3,000 new cases that will be coming into our county courts. And so we're obviously trying to staff that up as well. And then Senate Bill 191, which was passed in 2019, really is to help support our jail system, or to help support people who are coming to jail, to make sure that we are releasing them quickly as part of that process. And so we're investing some additional staff to assure that that will occur as well. We continue to evaluate our ability to support the Americans with Disabilities Act, and so we are funding a team, we're actually adding people to a team in our HRCP, Human Rights and Community Partnerships team, to help support that programming in the city. We will continue to support the Legal Defense Fund for Immigrants and Refugees, so that will help leverage additional funds in the community. So we invested in that, in 2018 and 19, and we'll invest in that again in 2020. When our colleagues from Parks and Recreation come and speak with you, they'll talk a little bit about the investment that we're making in increasing rec center hours, as well as continuing a Swansea Day Camp, which was formerly funded by grants and now will be funded by the general fund to continue that programming to youth in that community. I have two slides here on mobility and transportation options. This is really the operating side of investments that we've made for 2020, both in Vision Zero, and if you think about our transit investments, it's really trying to move people out of their single occupancy vehicles and have them use more public transit, which has a great nexus with our climate efforts as well. And we'll continue to invest in our multimodal planner as we think through updating our 2008 strategic transportation plan. We also are investing in FlexRide, which is a micro transit service, and it actually leverages other grants, but it's really to help increase the number of transportation options in neighborhoods that don't have as many options. So our friends in Public Works will be able to come and chat with you a little bit more about that in depth. And then we continue to, this is the operating side of Safe Routes to School and more education for 2020. But you'll see on this next slide, there are also some capital investments that we're making for mobility and transportation, including increasing the design and miles for bike lanes. We'll also invest some additional dollars, capital dollars, in transit. There's infrastructure that we can invest in to help advance Vision Zero goals. We're continue to prioritize pedestrians and try to figure out more investments in safe crosswalks for our pedestrians. There are some additional dollars as the capital side of Safe Routes to School that we'll be investing in as well. And then we continue to evaluate everything we can do to help meet the goals of the Mobility Action Plan. This does not, by the way, include any of our Elevate Denver bond dollars listed here, but we certainly have those available to you as well. I'm going to touch briefly on safety. There's a lot on this slide, but what you should just know is that we're increasing the number of police officers for 2020, and there's the costs associated with additional police officers in 2020, and Chief Pazin will be here tomorrow to talk to you a little bit more about that. In fire, in addition to helping to support and make sure that we're meeting the needs of the airport, who, by the way, pays for those services, we'll add some firefighters, but also Chief Tade will talk to you a little bit about the medical unit, which is really a more innovative way to respond to medical emergencies in the city. I mentioned 191, and this very first bullet under sheriff is really to help support that, to make sure we have a timely release of folks coming into our jail and to our intake. We also always have safety in mind and make sure that we're supporting the staffing needs of our jails, which includes Building 2022, which will need some additional staff and support. And then we are adding courtrooms, which means we also have to add sheriffs to staff those. You have a whole session on climate on Friday, but these are just a couple of the highlights, of the preview of some of the things that we'll be talking about on Friday, as well as agencies in their presentations to you will be covering the various ways that we're investing in 2020 to help advance our climate goals, to assure that we're protecting the environment. These are a couple things that you won't see because they're not part of an agency's budget or an agency that's actually presenting this week. So the first one is campaign finance. So in November, voters supported a campaign finance ballot initiative, which requires the city to invest $2 million in a fund. And so that's part of 2020's budget. We also are investing an additional $400,000 in outreach for the census, which is actually in our colleagues, HRCP, who I mentioned earlier, Human Rights and Community Partnerships. They're continuing to invest to make sure that we can leverage, make sure that people are participating in the census, because that's very important. There's a couple items that are multi-agency investments, and one of them is PBI. So for the National Western Center Triangle, you will be hearing from NUCO tomorrow, but I want to make you aware of the fact that there are also dollars in our city attorney's office and the PBI office, as well as in capital, to help support that initiative moving forward. There's also T21, so it's really raising the age for people to purchase tobacco. And so we have an investment that we're making in our DDPHE, Denver Department of Public Health and the Environment. So they're doing some investigators. We're actually supporting that. And then on the excise and license side, who you won't be hearing from, I just wanted to point out we're also investing in staff there to help monitor the licensing around that, and there will be revenue to offset those two positions. So I wanted to also make you aware, you won't be hearing from our independently elected folks or independent organizations, so I thought I'd just do a quick highlights to talk about how we've invested in them as well. The auditor's office has asked for additional positions to help support the minimum wage, and so we have supported those investments. I also want to point out that we did not ask for any budget savings from our independently elected officials, so I just wanted to this dawned on me to mention that to you here. And then for the clerk and recorder, because we do have a general election, a presidential election coming up, we will be investing about $1.6 million in additional staff that will be needed to help support the election, as well as equipment associated with that. Our clerk, our new clerk, has also asked for some outreach staff, and we've invested in outreach staff. Last November, in addition to the campaign finance ballot initiative, there was also a request to increase an appointee in the clerk's office. So the first time that will happen is in 2020, so we've added dollars to fulfill that vote. Our county courts are actually one of our primary agencies that will be responding to that, to 1263, which I mentioned earlier, having those additional cases come through their courtrooms. So we've invested in staffing for them. And that number is actually wrong. That is not 1.2. It's actually $600,000 that we're investing in an additional courtroom in the county, the city and county building, to create a new courtroom. That 1.9 actually belongs under the Office of the Municipal Public Defender. So we are actually building out some additional space for our Office of the Municipal Public Defender. And in addition to the additional space that we're building out for them, we're also providing them with some additional dollars for courtroom support and also some software that they had requested. And then I'm going to circle back to the district attorneys because there were some additional, there were two district courtrooms that were built out in 2018 and 2019. We are also providing some support to assure that they can have staff for those two new courtrooms. With that, I am going to turn it over to Laura Perry, who's going to walk you through the Capital Improvement Program.
Good afternoon. Laura Perry, Capital Planning and Programming Director with the Department of Finance. I do, similar to Stephanie, want to take a brief moment to recognize Emily Snyder, our Capital Budget Manager, who's currently on maternity leave. It is the year of the baby in Department of Finance. And, of course, the Capital Team and the Capital Planning and Programming Division for all of their hard work on the Capital Budget. So throughout the next several slides, I'm going to cover the 2020 Annual Capital Improvement Program, including revenue, expenditures, our capital planning process for this year, and, of course, our capital project highlights. As Brendan referenced earlier, we continue to see very strong financial performance in the city's annual capital improvement program. For 2020, our revenue is estimated to be $193 million and is comprised of the five sources of annual revenue, including Winter Park, the Entertainment and Cultural Fund, the State Conservation Trust Fund, Parks, Trails, and Open Space, and of course our Capital Improvement Fund. So starting with our parks dedicated revenues, the lottery funding and Winter Park are dedicated solely to parks capital maintenance and total $11 million collectively for 2020. And of course, in addition to those two revenue sources, we are pleased to have the benefit of the Parks, Trails, and Open Space sales tax, which will provide an additional $19.8 million on top of that $11 million that I referenced in 2020 for parks capital projects, which will maintain and enhance our park system. The entertainment and cultural tax, also known as the surplus seat tax, is estimated to be $14 million for 2020 and is dedicated to the capital maintenance of our performance venues and theaters in the city. And last but certainly not least, our capital improvement fund, shown in blue at 34%, is the lion's share of the city's annual capital improvement program and consists of property tax, highway users trust fund dollars supporting transportation investments, and other sources. It's really important to note that the capital improvement fund includes 2.5 mils in property tax specifically dedicated to capital maintenance that was approved by voters in 2007. This is estimated to generate $53 million for capital maintenance in 2020. In addition to the base revenues that I just mentioned, the capital improvement program is also supported by transfers from other funds, including the general fund. The general fund transfer for 2020 is estimated to be $14.25 million, as well as an additional $11 million transfer to support technology investments. And that is all encompassed within that blue slice of the pie chart. It's important to mention that our annual capital improvement funding is supplemented by bond funding and grants to support the citywide implementation of our capital projects. And these projects are delivered in close coordination with our annual CIP projects. Moving to the expenditure side, this pie chart exhibits the investment by department across the budget in the 2020 capital program. You'll note that Public Works receives the majority of the funding in the capital program as they manage the city's largest asset class, which is transportation, and are charged with the implementation of capital projects across the city. Not referenced here, we have held about $5 million in reserve in unappropriated contingency for unforeseen events that impact capital projects. These funds are unappropriated and require City Council action upon usage. Moving to our annual capital planning process. So beginning earlier this year, city departments engaged in a comprehensive capital planning process, which engaged the community to update the city's six-year capital improvement plan, develop the five-year plan for the parks, open space, and trails sales tax, which is approved by City Council in June, and inform project priorities for the 2020 capital improvement program budget. Throughout this process, we held five town hall meetings during which we were able to educate the public on the city's capital program. And through that process, we received over 1,000 public comments through comment cards, an online survey, and other targeted outreach efforts. The input received during these efforts informed the city's capital planning process for the budget. Focusing specifically on the 2020 program, several key strategies guided the 2020 capital improvement program budget this year. These included supporting citywide priorities that Stephanie referenced earlier and contributing to the Denverite or the comprehensive 2040 vision elements with a specific emphasis on equity and the city's race and social justice initiative. Denverite was once again used as a foundation to align capital investments with the citywide vision. The two Denverite vision elements that were most focused upon this year were equitable, affordable, and inclusive, and well-connected, safe, and accessible places. Next, we focused on continuing previous investments that required limited operating investments to manage the financial burden on the general fund. We looked to invest in maintenance and critical maintenance and safety improvements. And lastly, of course, leveraging additional funding from local, regional, and state partners. Equity continued to be a major focus in the city's capital planning process this year to ensure that capital projects provide community benefit and support the ability to access opportunity. This year, capital departments individually evaluated capital projects with an equity lens using the Access to Opportunity map and our Comprehensive Plan 2040. The map shown here represents all 2020 annual capital improvement projects comprehensively and show alignment with areas of the greatest need for access to opportunity. You will hear further from each department as they come forward, primarily Parks and Public Works, on how they evaluated equity and race and social justice within their respective capital programs. A quick snapshot on our expenditures. The capital improvement program is structured into three expenditure areas: financial obligations, our annual maintenance program, and system enhancement capital projects. Financial obligations are city's annual payments through agreements or debt issuance obligations that we need to meet. This is approximately $31 million for 2020. The capital maintenance budget is over half of the capital improvement program, and this is in light of the 2.5 mills that were approved by voters in 2007. We continue to prioritize maintenance very high in the city's CIP program. And last but not least, our system enhancement projects, totaling about $54 million for 2020. These projects seek to improve quality of life and expand the transportation system, and really focus on improving and expanding our asset classes within the city. I do want to mention on maintenance, we have begun to very closely track our investments in life cycle sustainment of the city's assets, which is essentially keeping up and keeping assets in good repair, as well as catching up, which is our deferred maintenance category, ensuring that we are appropriately keeping up with our assets to ensure they're here for 100 more years to come. Project highlights: the city's capital improvement budget includes projects that really embody the vision set forth in Denverite, resolve those critical life, safety, and maintenance needs of city assets, result in the forward progress of the Mobility Action Plan, and launch new opportunities for parks, trails, open space, and social services facilities. To quickly highlight, Stephanie referenced the major transportation highlights. The first chart references a couple of more specific ones. The one not mentioned in the previous slide is our Washington Street connections, and this is the design of the bridges to connect in to the National Western Center site, budgeted at $400,000 in the 2020 budget. For parks and recreation, several high-level investments in Heron Pond, continuing to build out that regional park and water quality facility, replacement of the turf at Park Field, improvements to the Montclair Recreation Center, and of course, again, the $19.8 million from the sales tax approved last year. And last, the 2020 capital budget does include a solid investment in facilities across the city, including the Roslyn campus for continued safety improvements, security and safety improvements around city buildings, a refurbishment at the elevator at the Denver Performing Arts Complex, citywide courtroom investments, citywide shelter facilities, the 2.5 for Crossroads that was referenced earlier, and then a $9 million transfer from Denver Human Services into the Capital Fund to support the renovation of the Castro building to include the client-facing areas and customer experience. And again, you will hear more from departments as they come forward later this week regarding these projects. We did want to take the time to mention two things to you today. The city has worked over the past 2 years to develop a phased participatory budgeting initiative to engage the public in financial decision-making processes for neighborhood-level capital investments. The initiative will be focused on small-scale projects to provide community benefits within areas of the city that have greater barriers of achieving safe and complete neighborhoods. We will be providing more detailed information in the coming weeks regarding the locations of the participatory budgeting initiative and associated process in 2020. And then last, the second major item is the third issuance of the Elevate Denver bond that will allow for the city to continue to make progress on the vote on the projects approved by voters in 2017 as part of Elevate Denver. And the third issuance is scheduled to move forward to City Council for approval next month. To date, the city spent over $100 million in our Elevate Denver bond program, and we look forward to continuing to make great progress on those projects.
So briefly on next steps, the following slide has our hearing calendar. At 2:30, I get to come back up and present on the Department of Finance, and Technology Services will be soon thereafter. And then we have a full week ahead of us with pretty much all the major agencies presenting. Those agencies will be presenting an overview of the agency and its goals, performance metrics, highlight of increased areas of resources, budget savings, decreases, and race and social justice slide as well. And then lastly, we just wanted to make sure we included a slide that described the overarching charter process as it relates to the budget process. And with that, I will open it up for questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Brendan, Stephanie, and Laura, you did a great job of keeping within the time constraints. Wanted to make sure that my colleagues had plenty of time to answer questions, and want to first off welcome Council Members Kanich, Torres, and Hines to the table. And first up, we have Councilwoman Black in the queue.
Thank you. I have a question. You might have answered it, so I apologize. At the beginning, you had a few slides on business confidence and consumer confidence. Can you just explain how that's measured?
Sure. Let me go back to those slides. So, Councilwoman, one is led by the Leeds Business School, and they do interviews. They have a survey that they send out to Colorado businesses, and they complete that survey and they extract data from that. The other national consumer confidence survey is run by, I can't remember the name of the organization. I'll get you the name of the organization, but they have their own methodology that's different from the Leeds School, but it's also a survey format where they go out and they collect information from consumers across the country and then pool it into this index.
Okay, thank you.
Councilman Flynn.
Thank you. Brendan, on Slide 18, just a little more on the 2A mills. You're estimating a credit of 2 mills to stay under the cap. And how many mills will be parked now as inactive with those two?
So we will be, our estimates are over 9 mills. So
nine.
This is a pretty important thing to provide some context to. Right. So for those of you who are watching at home, in 2012, when we passed ballot measure 2A to remove those Tabor restrictions, we had 6.22 mills that were being credited on taxpayers' bills. We were coming out of the recession. We utilized 4 of those mills to provide city services. My Denver program, street paving, a whole additional police and firefighters, a whole host of services. And since that time, we have grown that credit from 2.2 mills in excess of 9 now, is what we're assuming as we move into 2020.
So we essentially have 50% more mills parked than we did in 2012, which is kind of, I don't think that's what we expected. And this is just the general fund mills.
So those are for all affected mills. So that includes the general fund, component of capital improvement program, mm-hmm. social services, police and fire pension. Those are the mills that are affected or are capped in aggregate.
And for how long are the restrictions in effect? Are they permanent? The restrictions on how, for the reasons that we can reactivate those mills once we have room under our own cap?
Those restrictions are permanent.
They're permanent, okay.
In non-reassessment years, like we did with the half mill for affordable right. housing, we can activate a mill.
Right.
But it has to be during that non-reassessment year, or at least it has been recently, because we have been so far in excess in our valuation growth that right. we've had to float those mills down.
That was my last question, is how much has the tremendous growth in residential value in the city driven those mills out of our budget and into the parking area?
That has been the entire driver.
Okay.
I would
Thank
never
you.
Have forecasted that.
Wow. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Councilwoman Kanich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Wanted to ask about the staffing and overhead costs for the bond. We had a vibrant debate about whether mm-hmm. those things should be in the general fund or come from the bond, and the mayor had a very persuasive argument. You don't want to pay interest on staff, but given the budget situation, did you guys, so one, what's the total value of that? And two, did you evaluate whether or not, given the budget tightening, it was time to move them from the general fund onto the bond ledger?
Laura, do you remember what that estimated number is?
I don't have that information.
Get it
for you.
Yeah.
Did you guys debate?
We did debate it as part of this process. I think we felt like we had enough tools available to us to satisfy the priorities that we had, well, not satisfy, but advance the priorities that we had in front of us. It was a topic of conversation. I'll just tell you that the last time we did that was during the Great Recession. I think it's a very easy recessionary tool to use. The other benefit of doing it actually in a recession is that usually your pricing for your projects are increasing, and I think we still have concerns around those construction costs, and if we were to shift those over, there's a higher risk to having to scale down and scope down those projects at this point in time.
Okay, thanks. The other question is, if you can just walk through it a little bit, so we have some remaining contingency for 2019. You know, we don't know yet what we don't know about what might get used in the next 3.5 months. So talk a little bit about where that amount is now and where it goes should it roll over into 2020.
Stephanie, do you want to
Sure.
provide the most recent number? I'll talk about the second part while she's looking up the number. So to the extent that contingency, that 2% charter requirement, is not used, it would lapse and roll into fund balance. That fund balance is then rolled to the next year. But I will tell you that fund balance, that calculation, is attributable to both savings, expenditure savings or costs, as well as revenue. So it's the net impact. So if we don't perform up to our forecast, that would be a detriment to our fund balance. If we save money, that is a positive to our fund balance. If we overperform our revenue, that is a positive to our fund balance. So it all, there's multiple factors that go into it.
Yep.
Councilwoman, are you talking about the contingency, or are you talking about undesignated fund balance?
No, she's talking about contingency.
Contingency, yeah. So we are at $28.3 million currently in contingency.
Okay.
And I think We didn't talk about it here today, but one of the things we talked about for 2019 was that we have a goal of $19 million we should come in under appropriation to assure that we meet our 15% and all of our goals for 2019. So we are counting on at least $19 million. Does that make sense? We talked about that with agencies, that they've set aside some dollars. We're managing positions to assure that we meet an unspent amount of $19 million.
Is that on, I'm sorry, I didn't understand. Is that on, is that on top of the contingency? So
It could include the contingency. As you know, contingency, we have to sort of wait through the year. And actually, I will be coming to you in October with those supplementals that I'll be requesting your support on.
So can I just share a scenario to make sure I understand?
Absolutely.
Like if there was $10 million left in contingency, you need $9 million in agency savings to make up what you planned for in
That's
this
right.
budget.
Okay. That's exactly right.
And then can you just refresh me on what you assumed as the undesignated fund, or no, I'm sorry, the 15%, how much over that you assumed we'd be at the end of the year in terms of what you rolled over in the base budget?
Sure. So in our Schedule 100, which is Councilman Flynn's favorite page in the budget book, we are anticipating that we will actually come in about $3.6 million over our 15%, and we have already allocated that as part of the 2020 budget. So just as a comparison, if you look at the Schedule 100, you'll see that we were, in 2019, anticipating spending $66.7 million. So you can see that there's quite a difference there.
$3.6 million. Thank you.
That's right.
All right. Thank you, Councilwoman. Next up, we have Councilwoman Ortega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brendan, I have a couple of questions. The first one is actually a request for just a complete list of any of the fee or rate increases that we have associated with the 2020 budget. So if you could share that sort
Absolutely.
Of as a separate list, that would be very helpful.
We'll share it with all council members.
Yes, please. When was the last time the OPT was raised, and what was that base at the time?
I will have to get back to you on that, Councilwoman. That was before my time here, so okay. I'm not absolutely sure, but we'll work with the city attorney's office and do that research.
Okay, thank you. That would be helpful. And then, so the merit increase is at 3%, but DERP is now taking 1.5% away from the employees. So what does that leave as the net increase for employees after you deduct out what would be taken from them in their that rate increase? I mean, I don't think they're exactly equal, right?
It isn't exactly equal. So when we budget for merit, that's the average amount available to any average employee,
right.
But there's a range that's established by OHR that provides a greater minimum and maximum as well. So it depends on where they fall in that line. But if you just use the average employee in your question, that's 1.25%. That's net in terms of an increase above and beyond that cost for the pension contribution.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I had a couple of employees reach out expressing concern about that. So it looks like they're getting, you know, the 3%, but then we deduct out that other contribution. On slide 30, if you could provide a breakout of what that $3 million entails, if you have that at this point in time, I think that would be helpful.
Absolutely.
And then my very last one is, on slide 33, does that include what we may need to solve part of the issues with the community correction situation for the Department of Safety? There may or may not be some additional costs associated with that. For example, if we end up having to purchase buildings which may or may not be owned by the current operators. So
it doesn't assume any additional city contributions. I understand that that is going through a deliberative process, that they're working through that challenge at this point in time. When we formed this budget, we didn't have any proposals at this point.
Okay. So we may or may not see something during the time frame when agencies come and bring requests forward. I'm not sure we're going to have that resolved by then, but.
Yeah, I doubt you'd see a modification in terms of a revised book, but okay. I know that that team is working really hard to resolve that issue, and they've been in touch with the Department of Finance to kind of bring us into the loop as they progress. Great. So.
Awesome. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Councilwoman. Councilman Hines.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Most of my questions have already been answered. I just want to just ask two other questions. So back on slide 30, HRCP is getting funding for ADA compliance. That will be answered in detail another time. Is that correct?
We could get you some detailed information and refer you to also to the budget book section. But if you'd like a deeper dive, be happy to.
Great, because that might answer other questions that sure. I had about that as well. And then the T21 tobacco enforcement, the 250K, that is in anticipation of something passing through council, is that correct?
Yes.
I believe so, yes.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Councilman. Councilman Herndon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Slide 13, curious with just lodgers. I know it's new, the Gaylord. Do we have any idea hearing from Visit Denver how we believe this is going to have an impact on our lodgers tax?
So, Councilman, it was a topic of conversation in, just before the Gaylord opened. I would say from my perspective, and this isn't Visit Denver's weighing in on this, our lodgers tax has continued to perform strong in 2019. I think there's still concerns as that facility gets entirely up and running, not saying that they're underperforming at this point in time, but I know it takes multiple years to kind of come up to full capacity, that the Visit Denver is still watching it. And we consult with Visit Denver when we set our lodgers tax estimates as well to make sure that if they have concerns like that, it's baked into our estimates. But so far, we've been pleasantly surprised in terms of our year-over-year growth rate.
Great, thank you. And if any of these questions can be waited until the specific agencies, I'm fine with that. Slide 17, marijuana. If you could just briefly, we're the bottom when it comes to the role that council has to impacting marijuana tax. I want to make sure I read that correctly. That's the ability that council has to increase the sales tax for marijuana. I want to make sure I was looking at the right color.
Yes, I believe that is correct.
Bottom, yep.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah, the 5.5. Okay, right. I just want to make sure.
Correct.
I right.
Yes.
Got it.
Yeah. Okay. Now I got you. Yes.
Do we have an idea when you're thinking about projections how we believe that marijuana is going to continue to trend?
So we've seen a trailing off of retail marijuana's performance. It's still nearly 10% growth year over year, which is very strong. It's a small part of our overall revenue stream, but we've started to see some moderation, which I think I cautioned about last year during the budget process, because you had more states who were implementing retail marijuana, both adjacent to us as well as in California, and how that might affect our performance. So we're seeing some moderation, but it's still a fairly healthy revenue stream.
Okay. But that is an avenue when we're thinking about revenues that, as you say, think outside the box. That is something that there is the opportunity that we can move, not suggesting that we should, just right. That is an opportunity.
There's still an element of that rate left over. I think when we used it for the Affordable Housing Fund, I think we just got concerned about overutilizing that tool and creating a black market type unintended consequence, if you will. So, I think we continue to watch it.
And I appreciate Councilwoman Ortega asking about the DERP, because I had that question as well. And OHR, I'm not sure is presenting, but at the beginning of the year, typically health insurance increases. So there might be a circumstance where our city employees may end up seeing less than their paycheck if they end up choosing a plan that ends up costing more. That's 1.75 that we split between mm-hmm. city and employees. How much is that actual amount that the city will increase in spending? I'm just curious.
I believe it was $8 million was the value of 1.75.
7.8.
Okay.
So $8 million each way, city and our the employees are splitting that cost.
Okay. Correct.
Great. And Laura, my last question dealt with CIP. And, oh, I'm sorry, one more. Brendan, 35 other investments. The campaign finance, that $2 million, is that the one-time investment? Or are we doing $2 million every year?
It's $2 million every year up to a total, Sky, correct me, of 10?
Eight.
Oh, eight.
Okay, so we will
eight.
Have to, okay, so that's how you're just yeah. splitting it out four ways. Okay, thank yep. you. Now, Laura, CIP, on the facilities piece, now the previous council had a priority to take a look at the police academy, and that's not on the list. And so I'm just curious, I recognize new council hadn't had the opportunity to prioritize, but where are conversations with that? And if my new colleagues, you can come to a future police graduation and you can see, I believe it was the 1987 Police Academy, 1987, I think that was the first year, that we're still utilizing our training. I would invite our colleagues to come take a look at that. Where are the conversations with seeing if we can start that dialogue about a new facility?
In the 2019 capital budget, we have $100,000 programmed to progress programming for the Safety Training Academy. And what programming involves is essentially taking a look and refining the needs of police, fire, and sheriff to better inform location as well as the ultimate design of what that facility would look like, including square footage. So we are currently, that is an effort that is currently starting now, and so we anticipate having those results later this year to better inform next steps.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Councilman. Councilwoman Torres.
Thank you. Hi, Brendan.
Stephanie.
Good afternoon.
Question about RSJI. I know this was the first year that you implemented these questions for departments. How will you begin to qualify the difference that these are making in decisions on approved budget requests and even geographically, how that index applies to those approvals?
I think Erin Brown is also with us who leads that effort. So I think having her chime in would be very timely.
Good afternoon. Real quickly, yes, we will start to monitor each of those activities. We're going to be doing it in a couple of ways. As Stephanie Adams spoke to, we're in a process of really ramping up this work, and so we're still really training agencies across the board, all 20 agencies across our city. I think the other thing that's important to know, through this process, we'll be doing equity mapping. So we need to first understand and track what agencies are doing in their current departments, and then apply measurements to that. Also in this work, UC Berkeley is our evaluation and data partner. In this work that will also be evaluating how we're setting up all of our trainings, but how we're evaluating the citywide impact and the services that we're providing, the processes that we're adjusting to move this work forward. Is that helpful?
It is, and I look forward to how, I mean, I know that it'll be an ongoing process. One of the things that might help me, especially with the capital improvement planning funding is if we can see, if I can even see a difference between where capital improvement plan funds were spent the last time we did this and where they're spent this time, and in especially kind of identifying and marking out the neighborhoods that we have as high equity index neighborhoods, I would appreciate that.
That'll be something we'll continue to work towards.
Okay. The second question that I have, Brendan, thank you, Erin, is around the agency revenues and yes, the $4 million in credit card fee revenue
right,
from online transactions. Is this a reversal of the 2014 $2 million savings, or what we were going to eat basically as city in not charging people credit card fees?
Councilwoman, it's an element of that. You might remember that, well, you obviously do, that we implemented that back in 14. I think our credit card transactions for online payments at that point in time was hovering around 25%. We have now gotten up to 70%. So what we saw the fees as being in the past was a barrier to a more efficient way of transacting for the city. So considering the challenge that we had in terms of our financial position moving into 2020, knowing that this is a relatively nominal amount per each transaction, because it's I believe 2% or less of any given transaction, we thought it was more important to make sure we had the resources to provide to our main priority areas around mobility, equity, and whatnot, than it was to continue this practice, considering how strong our performance is in online payments.
Do you have a sense of which online transactions will be impacted by this?
I could get you that list. We did look at the different online transactions. It should be noted that no one who pays in person would have this apply to them, nor any of our DMV transactions would be impacted, because that's still an area we're trying to grow online transactions, but I could get you that list.
Okay. Thank you, Councilwoman. We've got Councilwoman Ortega back up.
Just a quick question about some of the fees, and I know you'll provide us a list, but are we still collecting photo red light fees because of the concern that we've all been apprised of related to the operator not having had a licensed, I think it was a licensed electrician that that installed or designed the technology. And so
I think we have Sky Stewart here from the mayor's office that can answer.
Sure. Happy to take that. While it's true that there was information shared that the original vendor for that program, Redflex, was not licensed to practice engineering in Colorado when they installed, those have long since been validated by licensed engineers in Colorado. We have a completely different operator now, so we are not concerned that the technology is not up to date and valid with the engineering standards of the state. So those continue to be collected. That program continues to operate.
Great. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, we don't have any other questions from council members, and so want to thank Brendan, Stephanie, and Laura for all of your hard work and your team and the multiple revisions of the budget. And we will take a quick break, and if everyone could be back in their seat by 2:30, we'll allow Channel 8 to switch over, and our next budget hearing is the Department of Finance, and so we'll
again.
See you back here in just a little bit. All right, thank you.